It's a great pleasure to be here as one of quite a number of ministers you're speaking with today, I think, and to speak to you about what is a most topical matter, and that is the issue of climate change. And I think it's useful to start by remembering a couple of things, and the first is where we have come from and what occurred at the last election. So at the last election, Australians sent all politicians a very clear message, and that was that they wanted action on climate change. Australians made it clear to all of us in the Parliament that they want to leave a decent legacy for their children. And you might recall that immediately upon taking office, Prime Minister Rudd ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and this was received with a standing ovation at the United Nations conference in Bali. And it did so because it signalled to the world that Australia was no longer part of the problem on climate change, it was now part of the solution. It also meant that of the developed world, only the US remained outside the Kyoto Protocol. So after a decade of inaction under the previous government, the ratification of Kyoto provided important momentum towards the development of the Bali roadmap. But of course, ratifying Kyoto is where our climate change program commenced, but it is not where it ended. And we have a colossal task ahead of us. Like the rest of the world, Australia's carbon pollution keeps rising. And despite the fact we have known the problem of climate change for some time, we keep adding to it and we keep making it worse. Gestures will not be enough to turn this around, nor will a loose assortment of random policy thought bubbles. What we need is serious reform. We need serious reform to get us where we need to go. It's important, I think, to pause at this point before we go into this sitting fortnight to remember why it is we need to act. We need to act because the climate is already changing. Between 1906 and 2005, the Earth's average surface temperature rose 0.74 degrees Celsius or 0.07 degrees per decade, and since the 1950s the warming rate has accelerated to 0.13 degrees per decade. That's nearly twice that which occurred over the last 100 years. There have also been increases in ocean temperatures to depths of at least 3,000 metres, rising average sea levels and extensive melting of snow and ice. Despite this evidence, there are some people who claim that the world has cooled since 1998. The fact is, globally, 13 of the 14 warmest years on record occurred between 1995 and 2008. And Australia has experienced warmer than average mean annual temperatures for 17 of the past 19 years. It is undisputed that our climate has varied in the past without human interference. The Ice Age is the obvious example. But we simply cannot explain today's changes in our climate by looking to natural cycles. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fourth Assessment Report is the most robust and most comprehensive analysis of climate change science ever undertaken. It is based on the peer-reviewed and published work of 1,250 climate experts from over 130 countries. It contains a detailed analysis of the influence of natural variations in solar radiation on climate, and the report notes that the sun's cycle of activity has been a factor in warming and cooling throughout history, but it also finds that while changes in solar radiation in the early part of the last century explain much of the global warming that occurred at that time, solar changes cannot explain the rapid warming the Earth has experienced since the 1970s. Greenhouse gases have played a much stronger role than solar changes in determining recent warming. The IPCC used a range of measurements to estimate how strongly different factors contribute to global warming and found that net human influences are much greater than changes in solar irradiance. In addition, the IPCC has conducted a careful analysis comparing climate modelling results and observed global and regional temperature increases. And when the combined effects of increasing levels of carbon pollution in the atmosphere and natural factors, including in solar radiation, are included in the climate models, the models produce a good simulation of the warming of the Earth that we have observed over the past century. But if the models are run including only natural factors, then they fail to reproduce the observed warming pattern. In other words, natural factors have been studied and they have been found not to be the cause of the climate change we are experiencing. Indeed, the IPCC have concluded that it is more than 90% likely that most of the observed temperature rise is due to human-caused increases in the concentration of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And as has been well documented by many reports, whilst climate change is having a big impact around the world, Australia is particularly vulnerable. And these impacts upon us will become increasingly severe over time. River flow in the Murray-Darling Basin may decline by 10 to 25% by 2050, and by 2100, the value of production from irrigated agriculture may decline by as much as 97%. And I think it's worth looking where we are now. Last week's drought update from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority presented yet another disturbing snapshot of how we are currently tracking. The drought update reports May inflows into the River Murray to be the third driest on record at around 90 billion litres against a long-term May average of 390 billion litres. The report also showed that the basin has experienced its ninth consecutive autumn with below average rainfall. The fact is, the longer we delay our response to climate change, the harder our job will become and the more it will cost. We cannot run and we cannot hide. We can't wish it away, and further delay will only make climate change worse. Climate change is with us already, and unless we act now, it will only get worse in the lives of our children and their children. So this fortnight, for the first time ever, the Australian Senate has the opportunity to turn around Australia's contribution to climate change. We have before the Senate legislation that will reduce Australia's carbon pollution for the first time ever. And without this legislation in place, Australia's carbon pollution will simply continue to grow. The scheme, the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, is built on the philosophy that we do not have to shut down our economy to tackle climate change. We can continue to grow our economy by breaking the link between economic growth and emissions growth. And the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme builds the cost of climate change into all of our decisions, making it cost more to emit the carbon pollution that causes our climate to change. It will put a limit on our carbon pollution and it will create the financial incentives to find cleaner ways of doing business. And the CPRS is the central part of a comprehensive set of climate change policies that will move Australia towards a low pollution future. There is the record investment in energy efficiency as part of our nation building and jobs plan. There is the $4.5 billion being invested in research and development of new energy technologies through the Clean Energy Initiative. And there is the renewable energy target that will ensure by the end of the next decade the equivalent of all of Australia's household energy will come from renewable sources. And this legislation for the renewable energy target will be introduced into the House of Representatives this week. Passing this legislation will unleash investment in renewable energy projects around the country, with the expanded target set to take effect from the 1st of January next year. And in the past week, we have seen much noise from the opposition on the renewable energy target. And this is an extraordinary display of opportunism from the same people who ensured that renewable energy went backwards under the previous government. ABARE figures showed that renewables contributed 10.5% of our electricity supply in 1997 compared to 9.5% in 2007. So we must remember that those currently making noise about the government's renewable energy target were the same people who were advised in 2003 to increase the target to ensure investment was not stifled. This was advice rejected again and again by the Howard government. And we must also remember that the position the Liberal Party took to the 2007 election was a 15% low emissions target, a target 5% lower than the Rudd government's renewable energy target, with an additional catch because clean coal and nuclear were eligible under this target, meaning the uptake of technologies like solar and wind would have to compete with nuclear and clean coal. So given the Liberal Party and the previous government's record on renewable energy, it is difficult to consider the opposition's recent comments as little more than political point scoring and grandstanding. If they were serious about supporting renewable energy, if they were serious about taking action on climate change, the opposition would have done something while they were in government, and they would be supporting both the renewable energy target and the carbon pollution reduction scheme, rather than finding a further excuse not to act. These complementary measures, the renewable energy target, energy efficiency, investment in research and development, are important, but they are precisely that. They are complementary. Because even with all of these measures in place, Australia's emissions would still be around 20% higher in 2020 than they were in the year 2000, as opposed to being as much as 25% less than they were in the year 2000 if the carbon pollution reduction scheme is passed into law. That is why without this scheme, we will not confront climate change. Without this scheme, we will keep making climate change worse. And the simple fact is that without the carbon pollution reduction scheme, Australia has no means of delivering our targets, which are ambitious and necessary. We will reduce Australia's carbon emissions by 25% below 2000 levels by 2020 if the world agrees to an ambitious global deal, one that stabilises carbon dioxide equivalent in the atmosphere at 450 parts per million or lower. If the agreement falls short of that target, we will reduce Australia's carbon emissions by between 5 and 15% on 2000 levels by 2020, depending on the extent of international action. There are some who argue that we should go further, even suggesting this legislation should be blocked because it doesn't go far enough. I would simply point out that going further is not possible without causing massive economic disruption, if it is possible at all. Let's remember, our emissions are still rising. If the Senate passes legislation, our emissions will be up to 25% lower in 2020. If the Senate does not pass the legislation, our emissions will be fully 20% higher. The scale of this transformation cannot be brushed aside. We are, as many of you know, a highly energy-intensive economy. Just the 15% target represents a 34% to 41% reduction per person on 1990 levels, a far greater reduction in the carbon footprint of every man, woman and child in this country than many other developed countries would face with equivalent targets. And the scale of this transformation means we need an economic transformation. That transformation begins with the certainty of a price signal to investors. And until that certainty is provided, the investment Australia needs to move to a low-pollution future is simply in limbo. Australia has been debating emissions trading for well over a decade, and it has long been agreed as the best way forward for Australia to reduce its carbon pollution. This is demonstrated by the fact that both sides of politics went to the election with a promise to implement emissions trading. However, only one side has kept that promise. And the Liberal Party has gone backwards, retreating to its sceptical base, and the man who was once the Parliament's strongest advocate for emissions trading has abandoned his principles in order to protect his position. Nevertheless, we in the government will continue to push for this crucial and historic reform. We will continue to push for passage of the legislation. We have made responsible and necessary improvements to the carbon pollution reduction scheme to ensure that this long-term reform takes account of the current economic circumstances. For example, we put in place the global recession buffer to increase the level of assistance for emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries by 10%, taking assistance for firms eligible for the 90% rate of assistance to around 94.5% in the first year of the scheme, and those eligible for 60% assistance to around 66%. The carbon pollution reduction scheme passed the House of Representatives earlier this month, and next week the Senate will have to decide whether it will vote to reduce Australia's carbon pollution or whether it will vote to let it continue to rise. The Senate can decide whether it will help slow climate change down or whether it will help climate change accelerate. Unfortunately, Mr Turnbull and the opposition have rolled over to the climate change sceptics in their party room. and not satisfied with having delayed for in excess of 10 years in government under the previous Prime Minister, the Liberal Party now wants to delay forming a position on climate change at least until the next year. But I just want you to consider the form here. 7 times the Liberal Party have promised to make a decision, and 7 times they have delayed. First, they said they would make a decision after the Garneau review. Then they said they would make a decision after the Treasury modelling was released. Then they said they would take a decision after the White Paper. And when the White Paper was released, they said they would make a decision after the Pearce report. Then they bought more time and said they would make a decision after the Senate inquiry. Then they said they would make a decision after an inquiry by the Productivity Commission, forgetting that the Productivity Commission had already made a submission on emissions trading to the Howard Government Shergold report. And now they are saying they will make a decision after Copenhagen and after the United States laws on climate change have been passed. I have to say, when it comes to climate change, it seems like the Liberal Party have adopted the Peter Costello doctrine. We know that Mr. Costello spent the last decade saying, "I'm going to take the leadership." Now the Liberal Party continue to tell us that they're going to make a decision on climate change. Even now, the Liberal Party have left themselves an escape hatch. It's only a matter of time until the Liberal Party tell us that they need to wait until all the United States regulations are finalised before they can make a final decision. And do you know when that will be? Under the current timetable in the United States, that will not be until June 2011. Put simply, however, there is no case for delay because we know what we need to do. We need to start reducing Australia's carbon pollution. We need to give investors a clear signal so they can make investment decisions that factor in a carbon price, which will be crucial to reducing our pollution. And we need to help give momentum to the international negotiations that are so crucial for our national interest, for Australia's national interest. And this seems to be a point forgotten in the debate. The reason Australia is pushing for an ambitious global agreement is not just because we want to do the right thing for the whole of the globe. It is because it is in our national interest for there to be an effective and ambitious global agreement. If Australia and others take no action now, we will not secure a global agreement. We are expected to, and we must do our share. And it will be to his enduring shame that Mr. Turnbull left the negotiating room without even taking a seat at the table. However, as I have made clear, we will not be deterred and the government will continue to engage in discussion with the crossbenchers. And like all of us in the Senate, the crossbenchers will be held accountable for how they vote. Because it is not just the Labor Party and the Liberal Party that promised to introduce emissions trading. Family First went to the election with a commitment to introduce emissions trading. Senator Xenophon has made it clear he does believe we need to act on climate change, and it goes without saying that the Greens have campaigned on climate change for years. In fact, many Australians would find it staggering that a party that has campaigned for so long on the need to reduce carbon pollution would entertain, even for a minute, the prospect of blocking laws that would reduce our carbon pollution by up to 25%. Australians who cast a vote for the Greens at the last election never expected their vote might lead to Australia's contribution to climate change actually getting worse. So this government will keep working to find common ground. But the fact remains, Bob Brown has 5 votes, Nick Xenophon has 1, Steve Fielding has 1, and Malcolm Turnbull and the opposition have 37. No single person in this country stands in the way of action on climate change more than Malcolm Turnbull. So if the opposition supports emissions trading as it says it does, but doesn't agree with every aspect of what we are putting forward in the carbon pollution reduction scheme, there is a very simple solution. They can move amendments in the Senate. Their failure to engage constructively in the detail of this reform is nothing less than a failure of credibility and a failure of leadership. Because we have before us a unique opportunity for Australia, our first chance ever to reduce the carbon pollution that is causing climate change. So whether you are Labor, Liberal, National, Green or Independent, whether you take this opportunity will determine the prospects and the risks faced by the generations that come after us. So to all members of our Parliament, to all members and senators, to all leaders, there is a simple stark fact confronting us. Your legacy on climate change starts now. Thank you very much.
David Kobolov from Monash University. Senator, thank you for your talk. The Greens and Independents want you to be more ambitious. The Conservatives want you to be less ambitious. You're going to try and find more common ground to try and get the legislation through the Senate. But what happens if you can't? What are the implications for our stance at Copenhagen?
Well, I think there are two primary implications from that risk. The first is, and it's a fact that seems to keep being missed in this debate, we'll be on a trajectory where our emissions keep rising. So as a matter of practicality, Australia will continue to contribute and our contribution will increase to climate change. The other issue you raise is Copenhagen, and I want to say something briefly about Copenhagen if I can first, and that is I believe Copenhagen is one of those moments where if we falter, if we are unable to get a decision which really puts the world onto a different path, there will be very negative consequences for our children, but importantly it will be hard, very hard for the world to recover. And that is a bad thing for every country, but it's a particularly bad thing for Australia because, as has been so well documented, we are vulnerable to climate change. So our national interest is best served by striving for an effective and ambitious global agreement. I think it is also well documented that if every country sits around waiting for the other to move, then you end up in a standoff and continued paralysis. The fact is we already signed up to a convention that says we need to move, we need to demonstrate what our preparedness to reduce emissions will be, we need to show the world that we are prepared to do our share, and as importantly we also need to give investors here in Australia that signal that will begin the transformation, because this is a whole of economy reform that will take decades. I think Greg Gailey described climate change as a multi-decade investment, and what we need is multi-decade certainty, and that's what a carbon price gives. So people shouldn't underestimate the extent to which what is occurring in Australia has been and is one of the things that is observed in the negotiations, just as the United States actions and the need for other developed countries to put midterm reductions on the table. We are trying to build an agreement across quite disparate perspectives, quite different levels of development, but if we are unable to get action demonstrated by developed countries, then that agreement will become even harder to achieve. So we welcome the fact that other countries are also moving. We welcome the US movement. We welcome the fact that the European Union's had a trading scheme in place for years. And clearly the United States is pushing very hard to get cap and trade legislation through its Congress. What would be bad for the negotiations is for Australia to simply sit back again and say we're just going to wait and watch.
Penny, it's Gary Sleeve from Pilbara Regional Development. I forget what they call themselves now, so anyway. Just talking about human cooperation, which seems to be the biggest problem with climate change, getting people to cooperate, you know, and also change their behaviour and whatnot else. One of the things I can't understand is that in terms of people get to understand and come on board, mm-hmm. Why do governments talk about like 15% below 2000 levels by 2020, for example? Why not talk in terms of straight quant of tonnes, you know, X number of tonnes to reduce or okay. Things like that. To me, it puts up a barrier up between understanding.
Yeah, okay, it's 195 million tonnes approximately that we would have to reduce between where we're likely to be in terms of business as usual and minus 15. That's about 195 million tonnes. To just give you some perspective around that, the current voluntary market is, I think, around 2 million tonnes a year. The biggest investment in energy efficiency this nation has ever seen, which is the insulation in the nation building and jobs package, will yield in 1 year when it's fully rolled out, about 4.5 to 5 million tonnes. We have to reduce emissions just to get to minus 15 by 195 million tonnes. So that is why we need a whole range of policy measures, but those policy measures themselves, renewable energy, energy efficiency and so forth, will not achieve that level of transformation, that level of reduction. Critical to that reduction is a carbon price. That's why we need the carbon pollution reduction scheme. But there you go, 195.
Senator John Hepburn from Greenpeace Australia Pacific. I have two questions. First one about the emissions reduction target. And you know, the IPCC range we're looking at is, well, hoping to get to it in the negotiations, is 25 to 40% below. I'm wondering if you could just talk to why, what the basis is of you thinking or you putting forward that 25% is a strong positive signal for Australia to be playing in that negotiation. We've been arguing for 40% at the higher end of that range, given Australia's, I guess, status in the world, and we're a very wealthy country. But my other question was actually about industry development here in Australia in the renewables industry, and really welcome the Solar Flagships program and the renewable energy target. Our assessment of the renewable energy target is that it will drive investment in wind as the lowest cost renewables technology, but there isn't a systemic industry development program to develop solar thermal, tidal wave, geothermal and those other areas. So I was wondering if you could just talk to that, please.
Well, first on the target, and can I say, and I did reference it in the speech, I think it is disappointing that those who understand the urgency of the situation could possibly get themselves into a position where they're saying, because we don't think you're going far enough, we'd rather have a situation where Australia's carbon pollution continued to rise. I find that staggering. And I think many Australians do. You referenced the 25%. I'd make the point that in terms of actual reductions from where we are, and remember we started off a higher base than many developed nations, not all, but we do start off a higher base. From where we are to where we will go, we actually are putting more on the table than other developed countries have put on the table. Now, that is in part because we have delayed and in part because we are so carbon intensive and we have a very high per capita level of emission, which I referenced in the speech. So what that says to us is the task of transformation is relatively more challenging for Australia than it might be for other developed countries who have already started this work. I also want to make the point this is a continued process. This is a challenge that's not going to end at 2020. This challenge will continue. We're talking about a transformation of our economy. We're talking about a whole of economy reform so that we become much less carbon intensive than we are and achieve the sort of scale of reductions that I was discussing with the gentleman here. So I think it is important not just to focus on 25% but recognise you have to go further. But if you're going to get to the sorts of reductions by mid-century that we are required to get to, we collectively in the world and certainly we in Australia, if we want to play our fair share, then we have to get on the path of reducing emissions and starting that transformation. I likened it in the very first major speech I gave on climate change to the opening up of the economy under the previous Labor government, so the reduction in tariffs, other protectionist policies being scaled down, the floating of the dollar and opening up our financial services sector. I mean, those decisions have fundamentally changed the economy and the society in which we live today. This is that type of policy. The longer we delay, I think the harder the cost, higher the cost, and the harder that transformation will be. In terms of the renewable energy sector, as I said, you do raise that issue of an issue which has been raised with us. We did look at some of the issues raised. But we also have to recognise that there are different ways to achieve different policy objectives. We're in renewables. What we're trying to get is an incentive that pulls through renewables investment. We were keen to leave the eligibility the same as existed previously because that was our election commitment and also for simplicity's reason. We were also keen to try and not be too prescriptive about which technology would contribute. And that's essentially what your question goes to, is would you inside the renewable energy target pick different technologies? We were keen to try and minimise doing that because we don't know where... The whole point of the renewable energy target is to unleash investment and innovation in the renewable sector. So what we may think is the best technology today is probably not going to be the best technology in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. In fact, I hope it's not, because what we want to see is a range of technologies come to market. We want to see deployment, but we also want to see increased R&D. So the decision that was made was, look, we will continue to fund R&D and have grants-based program, of which the Solar Flagships is one, but not the only budget program for renewable energy, but we would leave the renewable energy target as we've outlined in order to bring forward investment broadly in renewables. As you might know, we do have an incentive for micro renewables, so micro generation, which will advantage, for example, solar panels or solar technology or other microgeneration. So there is an advantaging, a weighting of under the legislation for that purpose.
Greg Steele, Hyder Consulting. On the stick side of the equation, are you looking at amendments to environmental legislation, both federally and COAG with the state legislation, particularly new infrastructure?
The stick side. Well, there's been a bit of press about a couple of things. Look, can I say one of the reasons that we have advocated a market mechanism is we think that is actually the most efficient way of implementing this transformation. I think if you don't put in place a market mechanism, the choices government is then confronted with is a range of regulatory mechanisms, and that's essentially what you're referencing, which of course are not costless. They impose their own costs, and we would say often less efficient costs than a market mechanism such as we are putting forward to the Senate. So I don't want to go into the detail of some of what's been in the papers. There's obviously there will continue to be a push from different parts of the community for action on climate change. What I would say to those who are serious about action on climate change, and what I would say particularly to the business community, is those calls for action will continue regardless of what happens in the Parliament. We think it is far better to go down a market mechanism path than simply straight to a regulatory model, which is obviously part of what was followed in the European Union, some of which has been followed in the United States, and which there continue to be calls for here in Australia.